Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Yo.
Brian, taking a sip of a Diet Coke, let him drink that down and have that refreshing beverage. Brian Brushwood?
I've always wondered why my parents had such an elaborate middle name. I never understood why they gave me that, but now...
It sounds better in the original Russian.
Yeah, it's true that. Gentlemen, so I watched last night all four episodes. I thought there were three. I'm like, man, they really ended this on a cliffhanger. I'm like, oh, wait, there's a fourth episode of The Defiant Ones.
Ooh, what'd you think?
The story of Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. It is, for those of you who don't know, it's basically the story of how Iovine and Dre got together, both independently working in the music industry and in their collaborations together, and sort of the journey they have as both being music producers and then entrepreneurs, the creation of beats, hardware, et cetera, and all that. And an incredible success story. You know, they come from very different backgrounds, but equally challenging. Well, challenging in their own ways. And it is a very, very good, you know, examination of two people who I would argue are geniuses in their own way. You look at all Iovine's, as they say in Italian, you look at his history, the albums that he's touched, and then you look at Dre and what he's worked with, the artists he's worked with, and you see a lot of the similarities there. And one of the ingredients, I think sometimes it happens for really, really big success, and that comes into that you can only get so far on your own steam, so to speak, on your own sort of thing. And you look at right now what's happened with Justin Bieber. You know, he decided to, you know, cancel middle of a concert tour. And then we've had that other artist who said, hey, I'm going to stop in the middle of this concert tour because the pressure and everything on them is enormous and huge, and you're in charge of these big enterprises. And if you want to build something super huge, it's hard. You know, one of the few artists I think that's continuously been able to do that has been David Copperfield. And David Copperfield's, you know, probably worth as much as, you know, as Dre or Iovine, but David has worked nonstop since he was 19 years old. I mean, it's crazy. But both Iovine and Dre work with other artists, and that's part of what the secret of their success is they see greatness. You look at what they're able to bring out of people. You look at when, you know, Iovine created Interscope Records, and you see the different talent, the people he brought into it from very, very disparate sort of places. But this is the guy that helped break, you know, No Doubt. He helped Nine Inch Nails get out of their TBT contract, you know, Reznor, et cetera, and collaborated. And he was a person looking for talent and also looking for talent that worked with talent. And the same could be said of Dre, looking all the way back when he looked at Eazy-E, who was not a rapper, but always had that great voice that, you know, kind of was significant. And you look at how he continued on that. That was sort of a pattern I noticed in Dre, that he liked to work with artists that had different, really sounded different, like Snoop Dogg, et cetera. So that's part of my takeaway. Have you seen it?
I loved it. I was over the moon for it. Number one, it certainly scratches a lot of the nostalgia itches of just their heyday in music together, particularly Interscope Records, is pretty much, you know, a who's who for things that were hot when I was in my formative years. And, you know, just the, I love the way that the documentary was put together, where they didn't, I think there would have been a different take would have been to kind of tell things a little bit more linearly. And that would have meant compressing a lot of Iovine's story to get to the point where they're together. And I loved how the documentary basically told two parallel stories out of time until they meet each other, like over halfway through.
About 6 or 7 years apart, sort of the age difference there and where they were. And, you know, Iovine, one of the things I thought was really what I loved was they talked about his early days. He was got a job working as an assistant in a studio in the record factory, the record plant. And he talks about how early on it was 5 o'clock. He wanted to go home. You know, he was a guy that just wanted to clock in, clock out. And then at some point he decided, like, okay, I need to be focused, not just be a guy who's here to punch a clock and leave. I need to get into this. and something magical happened. It's Easter. He gets a phone call from the studio engineer, the head engineer there. He's like, hey, can you come in on Easter? You know, the other guy couldn't come in. And Iovine's like, I guess so, because he'd made this sort of decision. He was going to be more focused. He shows up, and who is there recording? It's John Lennon. And because he showed up that day, he got to be an assistant on a John Lennon, you know, session, which is kind of, you know, music that's like the most amazing things you could ever have going for you. And then he became a guy that became consistently really about the work, and to a point where he became a workaholic to a degree, to absolutely. But it was that intense focus. And that was sort of the same thing with Dre. Dre was a guy that just was living and breathing music. He's not a guy that said, I'm just going to use music as a means to get somewhere else. Music was a means to do more music. Music was a means to be around music. And when you pick the things that you want to do, and I deal with this people in writing, is that people like, I like to write a book, or I have an idea for stuff, and it's like a get rich quick scheme or whatever. It's not about the writing. It's not about the story. It's like, you know, you're 2 million books get published a year. You know, you can count, you know, self-publishing, 5 million books get published a year. And you just want to sort of maybe dabble. And same with music, is people like, oh yeah, I'm going to try this music thing, see what works out. It's like, it's lottery ticket mentality.
Oh, 110%. And that is really, you know, there's this great turning point in the Iovine element where not only does he get the kind of serendipity of working with John Lennon, but one of his first big gigs is working with maybe one of the biggest workaholic musicians in the business, Bruce Springsteen, who even now will do concerts that routinely last, you know, 3 hours, sometimes 4 hours, where the band doesn't take a break. They literally play through the entire time, and Bruce Springsteen is calling songs on the fly for them to do, and that is in his advanced age. This was him breaking in, and they go through one of the guiding kind of recurring principles is that both of them are just these obsessive workaholics, and it's always
2 weeks
just
trying to get one song. 2 weeks, yeah. Trying to get one song.
And how meticulous. It's like, nah, I don't like that sound. Let's keep trying that sound. And to Dre, you know, it affects him even now as almost kind of a sickness. You know, he's the one big album that he was supposed to release, he never released. And they kind of make the point of saying in the documentary, it's never going to come out because it was never right for him. And that's a part of it. But on the other side, they created everything that they created because of that relentless understanding of A, where quality was, and B, how to bring it out and how to put it out to people.
There was a really interesting thing that happened as sort of the industry changed when Iovine noticed that, like, looked at when Napster came out, they're like, this is going to F us. And it did. It had a huge impact because album sales took a tremendous drop. It was a changing environment, and it was, you know, they knew the world had to change, and adapting with that, we didn't get a whole lot. There was sort of this, you know, several years before they finally sort of kind of came up till Beats came out. But Beats, which was the brilliance of Beats as the headphones, was that you take a guy like Dr. Dre, who maybe it takes him forever to do his own, to release an individual album. He works on other albums, and he's got a wonderful brand. That brand of Dre is amazing because Dre has been impactful on so many other careers, you know, Eminem, Snoop, et cetera, all these people that he was very careful not to put his name on everything. You know, he didn't put his name on a lot of stuff because he wasn't a guy that was in a hurry to go endorse stuff. It was about music. And they had the conversation, you know, with Jimmy Iovine, which was the fateful conversation of like, well, they want me to do a sneaker thing. And then it's like, well, what about speakers? And boom, Beats headphones comes through, and you realize, man, like, you could take all of that capital Dre built up as a brand. And by also saying no to a lot of stuff, when he finally said yes to a thing that he liked or he believed in, he created a brand that ended up being worth $3 billion when it got bought by Apple, which tells you that sometimes, like, saying no, maybe there can be a payoff down the road if there's a reason for it, when you find the right thing to do.
Man, that's something I have a terrible time with, is saying no to anything. Just I'm like a child with an attention span of nothing. And the moment somebody shows up, you're like, hey, please do blank. And I'll think like, well, I can't think of a reason not to say yes, so let's go.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question then, sir.
Yeah.
I would say that we're all in sort of similar situations. There are things we like to do, and there are things that we get paid to do, you know, and maybe sometimes it's doing TV stuff. So maybe sometimes like this, it's podcasting. You know, I would say books are to me what podcasting are to you guys.
Mm-hmm.
But we're always trying to figure out, like, what's the form of what we want to do? And, you know, for Dre, the form of it was music. The huge payoff ended up being, well, he was already super wealthy. But I mean, the payoff with like Beats was, hey, I know a lot about this one thing, and that gives me credibility over here that helps there. And I think that a lot of us were looking for that, you know, the Ice Cube tray to spill inside of and to form into. You know, we're looking for that. This is where you need to be. This is what you need to be doing. And that's hard when it's something that's as amorphous as I'm a broadcaster, I'm an entertainer.
Yeah, but also, Brian, I think that you do, you're more discerning than I think you give yourself credit for, because if Universal came to you and said, hey, we want you to be a regular, a year-long show inside Universal Studios, I think now you would probably lean more toward the no side of that than you would maybe 5 years ago or 10 years
well,
ago.
Well, what if Universal Television said, we want you to play the Amish brother, and this is a serious question, on our new TV series that's coming out?
Well, hold on. Let's not throw anything out of hand. The TV thing, I do think there's a soft spot for the legitimacy of TV that I think I would fall for. But I think you're right, Justin. I think 5 years ago I would have leapt at the opportunity to be the big frog in any singular pond, but nowadays it's a little more challenging as I look around and I'm like, oh, I think we've built a little bit of a pond here. In fact, that's one of the things that I need to stop doing is I need to get better at saying no to any gig that takes me out on the road, because it's an earthquake to the production of everything that we're doing here in this media conglomeration of independent podcasters that we have and so on.
Well, or the price has got to go up, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, I think that's the big thing is like, hey, look, there's Brian, the college performer. If you're not, you know, Michigan or Florida State or these, you know, these major state schools that can afford to pay, you know, for, you know, the top music acts.
Sure.
Then it's not worth it for you to pack those cases and even do the one man version of it, let alone like. Doing other stuff. I mean, you would probably have a better shot, you know, taking 1% on a referral for all that stuff than you would do anything else if you wanted to even make money on it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
But I think the larger point is the no isn't a no if it's a yes to this other thing that you're doing. And for Dr. Dre, the yes was in a very image conscious field. He was saving his powder for stuff that he really believed in or stuff that he had more ownership on. And, you know, not to say that that's always the right answer, because, you know, one of the guys who's interviewed a lot and looked at as one of the biggest media moguls is Sean Puffy Combs. And he did almost the exact opposite. He put his name on a million different things and they did really well.
And I would say the thing about him, though, is that Sean Puffy Combs, Sean John cared about things like fashion. He cared about brands. He knew what he wanted. So he lent his name, but it wasn't like, hey, we want you to endorse this. How much is it? It's like, well, do I like it? Is this good? Does this fit what I like? And so he's a designer. And he's kind of got a designer mentality. And so I'd say it was true to him in that, like,
yeah,
there's things he wouldn't endorse, you know, and that's a clear thing to be. Because a lot of people are like, oh, I want to be like this thing. I want to have a brand. Like, do you know anything about this, you know, not to say that you can't, but do you care about this is an important question.
Man, that's the weird thing. Like brand management is one of those tricky beasts where it's like, it's only because it's a shared delusion that it even exists. And most people don't even know what their brand is. It's very difficult to know how you're perceived by other people, much more difficult to know how to put a dollar figure on loaning your name, your identity, your backing to something. And it's something that a lot of people do for free and they probably shouldn't do for free. And then other people charge a lot, maybe shouldn't charge a whole lot. I don't know.
It's in their trade-offs there. And I'll give you an example. Like for me in writing is I get people that people know I write way more than I release. I'm like, oh, have you thought about like releasing under a pen name? I'm like, well, problem number one is if under a pen name, I can't promote it in this day and age without a publisher behind it, it wouldn't necessarily make sense. The other thing is that if I only release like the top 30 or 40% of what I write, my quality tends to be very, very high. Now you take a guy like James Patterson, who has, you know, and has, you know, previously was did wrote great stuff. This guy was an Edgar Award winning writer. He knows his stuff, but his model is he works with other writers. They turn these books around fast. So you're getting a book a month from him and his team. And the quality isn't, you know, it's not what we've seen him. He can do when he's focused on one book over time, whatever. But for him, you know, he's one of the wealthiest authors in the world, and he's entertaining people. He's not selling crack cocaine, you know, in the way some writers talk about him. And like, I get what he's doing. He's like, for a lot of people, there are different kinds of audiences when it comes to books. There are people who just read one book every average person doesn't read books, number one. Average person doesn't read books. And then you get this bell curve distribution. And it's a steep curve, actually, of like people who buy one or two books a year and then people who buy a book a week, you know. And there are people, I go to the library near me and they sell books there, and they tell me about a woman who comes in there who's reading like two books a day. And just insane. So there's high volume book buyers, whatever. And so Patterson's great for that. And you know, they said, yeah, the woman, she buys those books a day, you know, the kind of books she's buying. And like Harlequin trashy romances. I'm like, I'm not a book snob. I don't care. That's, you know, but point is, there's an audience
he
there.
He found a market. He found, and that's something that we found early on, especially in the ebook scene, like people burn through these things. Like they rip through them and all they want is another one. And that's a market that he is serving, and he figured that out. And so, you know, for Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, it was kind of a perfect match, because now all of a sudden you have this in a world where, yes, there are audiophiles, and Beats has certainly taken its lumps from audiophiles on the quality versus the price. But ultimately, the vast majority of people who are going to buy these kinds of headphones just know that they sound better than the free thing that came with their phone. Right.
Yeah.
So you have the name brand of Dre, Dr. Dre. He's the producer. We know him as the producer more than he is a rapper, and he's mega famous as a rapper. And Jimmy Iovine, who they go to kind of paint by numbers, no music artist in their right mind would say no to Jimmy Iovine asking the very simple favor: can you put on these headphones so I can take a picture? And that's the entire brand was built on him leveraging his connections to the music world, of which were limitless, and the fact that he's a marketing genius and realized, you know, he wound up getting into these scuffles with the Olympic Committee and the NFL, and because he would give athletes the headphones, and now it was millions and billions of dollars in free publicity.
So that part of it made – I had an epiphany, because – so what he did and what Justin's touched on was they gave out – you know, they made sure they gave NBA, NFL players tons of these headphones. And then we had, you know, our Olympic basketball team. They all had Beats headphones. They show up to go play, you know, basketball in the Olympics wearing these headphones. It's huge branding. And then they made like – Beats versions for every country, and they sent them to every athlete, and the IOC, you know, lost it because they make billions of dollars from endorsements, and here Beats is free riding on this. And so they banned the Beats headphones, which created even more controversy and even more attention, because now every news report, every sports show talks about Beats are banned. And for a brand that's Dr. Dre's associated with, a guy with NWA, effing beautiful, perfect. And I made a comment, Dre, I think Dre said it was, you know, we won't be able to pull that again. And I thought about that, like, yeah, they knew that trick worked once. They won't be able to do that particular trick again. And I started thinking about sort of the larger thing is that often we watch bios, we watch to see the success of people because we want to emulate or model that. But you can't model something because it only worked once for that person, and they can't even do that thing again. And that's one of the problems with entertainers is they try to like, I'm going to repeat the thing I did before. And you see that that fails, that doesn't work. You have to change it or innovate on it. And we look at people and go, well, I'm going to do what X does. I'm going to be an Instagram, and I'm going to follow this Instagram model. I'm going to do all the things that she did. And I'm going to have her success. Well, guess what? It's not working for her now unless she changes it, et cetera.
I am going to take the counterposition on this, because I believe, like, yes, of course, there are examples of trying to do the same thing and it doesn't work a second time. But I feel like that's more the exception than the rule. Like, looking back on doing marketing stuff, the best advice in one splinter universe, I only went on television once, and that was on The Roseanne Show, because I took a bunch of tubs of atomic fireballs and stuck VHS tapes in them and put a note on the side that said, hey, think these are hot, try eating fire, Brian Brushwood eats fire, and watch the tape for the rest of the stuff. The only reason in one universe I did it, I tried it, I did it once, and then I was done with it. But in this universe, thankfully, a friend of mine who was a marketing guy said, I was telling him, like, yeah, I don't know what to do next. He was like, well, I thought you said it worked really well. I was like, oh, it worked great. He's like, well, then you do that again. And then that doing the same thing, buying the same scratch off lottery
ticket. So if you sent the Brian, you're way drilling. You're what I'm saying is, like, and if you sent that fireball tub to the people at Roseanne, if I said, great, I want to get on Roseanne, that show, I need to send a tub of fireballs. Would that work for me? No, because that worked great with that group of people who were exposed to that wonderfully once.
Sure.
To do that with another talk show, that's a different thing.
Sure. Well, and you know, long story short, that's exactly what got me on the Tonight Show, was doing the exact same thing just for a different audience.
But that's my point, is that you didn't say, like, I want to get back on Roseanne's show again. I want to do a repeat. Let me send them fireballs.
Right.
You said, I will take this thing. I'm going to do it over here now.
Right.
You know,
right,
and that,
right.
I guess that's my point, is that, like, yeah, there would be no reason why I wouldn't think it would work over there. And I guess that you're saying, like, oh, well, let's try to get banned from the Olympics. Maybe it would work. But the idea is, like, as an artist, you know, you need to, we have to adapt and change and evolve. And if we're trying to be, you know, where the puck was,
right,
it's there. But, like, yeah, that thing worked great. And then the modification was different show.
Right.
Well, and that's what, you know, the Beats guys figured out, was that all these organizations are intensely brand conscious on what they can wear and what they can't, to the point where players can't, like, wear a special pair of socks that gives tribute to their mother that just died of cancer, because they aren't Nike socks that, you know, that Nike didn't give them special permission to make a pair of socks that do that, right? And you can't buy those socks, so you can't wear them, and they get fined for it. So the idea is, in this world where they're making all that money and they're so restrictive about it, man, wouldn't they throw a fit if all of a sudden literally everybody in the sport had these headphones and they are so excited because it's cool, it's social coup to wear these cooler headphones. Now all of a sudden it's an issue. And like you did with Roseanne and the Tonight Show and everything else, they went from the NFL to the NBA to the Olympics, and each one of them predictably reacted like you did. Now, the difference is that once they've burnt all them, and now everybody will send every athlete a bunch of stuff.
Hoping now to capture that magic again.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I'll give you an example of, like, and this was from, I forget which book I'm listening to, and it was either the Hitmakers, or I think it was Hitmakers. And it was talked about how, I think it was Tinder, like the woman who helped spread Tinder. She went to her old sorority, went to go to the college campus, and says, hey, I'm a woman entrepreneur. I'm working for this company, I think it's Tinder. Says, we have this app. It's a dating app. And says, I would love it if all of you would install it on your phone and put a profile on here. Could you do that for me as a favor? Goes to sorority, goes and does that. Goes down the street to a fraternity. Says, guys, hey, I don't know if you know this, but all the pretty girls over that sorority, they're on this app called Tinder. You should think about signing up. Take a look. And they take a look, like, hell yes. So they all sign up for the app. So now she's got on this campus, this sorority here, this fraternity there. Everybody else falls into place there. And boom, Tinder has these, can start building up around campuses and around and extend there. It's great. And the woman says, now when I got hired by, like, Bumble or whatever to go do the same thing, I show up at a sorority. They already have every app maker, everybody comes to them now trying to get them all to sign up. So they're all very savvy about this now, because that thing got played out, you know, and then it's, you know, and I could see that part of the story is fascinating, because you could see, like, huh, that's great. I'm just going to show up at a fraternity or sorority and get them all to do it. Well, 5 years ago, that was the clever way to do it. Now, maybe not so much. Now you need to think differently about it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that I don't know at which point I noticed it, but I figured out that it's like, I'm fond of saying I don't do lines, by which I mean, if a line exists, then that is an indication that there's an obvious way to get a thing. And the obvious way is to stand and wait an hour and then get to the whatever. Almost never in my experience is it the only way to get a thing, whatever that thing is. And whether it's paying somebody to stand in line for you or figuring out how to take the back elevator instead of the front elevator or whatever. Like the moment I see a line, I just think inefficiency, there's probably a better, lesser known way. And I always invest time, energy, and effort to figure out what that is. Sometimes with success, sometimes not.
Yeah. I think, knowing what works, knowing what other people do, knowing what your time is worth is absolutely critical. And sometimes you don't know. Sometimes I watched, The Founder, which is kind of another, I don't know if you guys saw that yet.
I watched that as well. I liked it very much. It was, I thought, fairly honest. I'm sure it wasn't as simple a story as it was presented, but I liked it for what it was.
I enjoyed it. And so The Founder, as you know, it's the story of Ray Kroc and the McDonald brothers and where McDonald's came from. I guess my issue with it was we never knew anything about Ray Kroc. And there he has had, this is a guy that was an ambulance driver at the same time, World War One, went to training camp the same time as Walt Disney, met Walt Disney. And you're like, there is the history of people who signed up to fall, be in the ambulance corps in World War One is fascinating because you find out so many amazing entrepreneurs that came from that period were young men that rushed to go do that. And it says something about, that. I mean, we'll forget the fact that Hitler drove an ambulance during that time too. But anyway, my point is, I enjoyed it. I read Ray Kroc's biography. I think it was called Grinding It Out. And it was a very interesting sort of overview of this, but you realize it's sort of similar to the Dre and Iovine story, is that this is a guy that spent years doing a lot of different businesses, a lot of different stuff. The thing that continuously made him money, though, was selling milkshake mixers to restaurants, and he became an expert on fast food restaurants. Not intentionally, but he went to so many of them. By the time he saw what the McDonald brothers had, he recognized the brilliance of it, and it wasn't like he necessarily set out, from what we understand, the bios or whatever, they set out to, he tried restauranteering to a bit, but once he understood what greatness took, what a great idea it was, he recognized it immediately and is willing to bet everything on it and fight for it to the point that, he may have been an unpleasant person, but that's that sort of thing. You look at man, what do you know? What do you now know more than anything else? Dre is a guy that knew more about music, knew more, and Iovine more about relationships with people and the fact that, if the three of us said, man, we've got a great idea for our own headphones that are going to be better than Beats, that's great. Nothing's ever going to happen to that because right. We could never afford to market that. And that's what they had, that is built-in, beautiful marketing system. For us, I think we all ended up into our own places because things fell in our lap. Opportunities fell in our lap, whether it was, Justin meeting you, Brian, whether it's, me being able to know you guys and say, hey, if I steal part of your audience and then I shill my books to them, maybe I can build up an audience of book buyers, et cetera. So helpful. It's determination and opportunity.
Agreed. We got picks. What are you feeling? I'll tell you what, I have a very kind of beige pick, fairly neutral. I think it'll appeal to a lot of people, but I'll be damned if day after day, week after week, they don't continue to put out really good content, and that is the fine folks over at NPR's Planet Money. Planet Money is I always feel like in an alternate universe, I was meant to be an economist because so much of economics just speaks to me. It makes sense, and Planet Money does a really good job to open up the way I feel about economics to other people. And my daughter is 13 years old, loves it, has fallen in love with it, listens to every single episode. It's good. They're good folks over there.
That's great. There is this understanding things from an economic point of view. And the problem is that to many people, everybody thinks they do. It's all about money. When you hear somebody, call Karl Marx the world's greatest economist, it's laughable. It's this is a guy that didn't even understand what was going on in his own time. And then people think that they're going to take cues from that. And it's a thriving study of that there's a lot of different approaches to things to it, but understanding the basics of just being able to describe how a thing works or what something happens is fascinating. And I've always had this sort of joke that, like, you know, like, I'm not a religious person, and my religious friend's like, oh, isn't it bother you about this? I'm like, I'm more of somebody's a Keynesian than if they believe in God, because that has more effect on me.
Sure,
and,
sure.
You know, so, and then no, Keynesians don't get upset. You have a right to your belief, as silly as I think it is. I talked to a friend of mine who is a very well-known, we'll say, classical liberal talking on economics and all that, who has a son who is getting their degree in economics at a very prestigious university. And I go, how's that going? He goes, I think he's becoming a Keynesian. Like, yeah, sorry, dude. It's like, yeah, you're a little smart. You think you can fix everything, you know? You think, you know? Yeah, well, so, yeah. Anyhow. Let people be people. So my pick is, I'll pick the Defiant Ones. That's my pick on right HBO. On.
Well, just to prove that we are indeed paid chills, I'm going to pick these brand new Beats X headphones that I got. Look at these things. $100, and I really like the sound on them. And they have the Apple. I think they're the cheapest headphones that have the Apple W1 chip in them. That's the same chip that is in the AirPods, rather. So it is just always connected to your phone. You don't got to worry about fiddling with the Bluetooth and everything. It just is, once it pairs, and you're good to go. But it's good for talking, good for listening, good times.
Excellent. Very cool. Amazing. I mean, watching the birth of that brand is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And you think there's just a handful of brands that you watch, you know, the last 15 years or so that become so iconic. And, you know, the rebirth of Apple, certainly. I would say that Amazon, certainly. It's interesting. Like, Facebook and Google, they're brands, but they don't necessarily mean anything. They do a lot of things. They do those things very, very well, but it's harder. And I would say that, you know, I think that many people have a very antagonistic relationship in some respects with them. Beats is just a neat, you know, very neat brand story. And, you know, watching that now with Tesla, you know, it's like you kind of know the strength of the brand by how loud the detractors are.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Tesla, particularly considered it's the biggest the stock with the biggest amount of short sellers out there, you see constant, you know, oh, why is this horrible? Why is it horrible? Whatever kind of thing, which I'm a fan. And so it's done very well for me. So anyhow, not an endorsement. Not a recommendation. I'm not a licensed financial advisor.
No.
Anyhow, gentlemen, it's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.